And welcome back to Dad's on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Our guest today is Peter Fitzsimons. Peter is Australia's best-selling non-fiction writer and the author of a new book called The Opera House, about Sydney's symbol. For the past 35 years, Peter has been a journalist and columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald and the Sun Herald. His books include Breaker Morant and The Incredible Life of Hubert Wilkins, both of which featured on Dad's on the Air. In a previous life, Peter has represented Australia as a wallaby and has the distinction of being sent off for an indiscretion when playing against the Brutes of the All Blacks. Peter, welcome back to Dad's on the Air.
Bill, good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Peter, I seem to have been waiting expectantly a long time for this book, and it took you 6 years to write it. I guess, is that par for the course with the Opera House, delayed until it's absolutely right?
No, it's not par for the course for my books. I mean, I turn my books around fairly quickly. You know, like in terms of other authors' works follow, I love using researchers to dig into archives to go deep, particularly in the age of the internet. The amount of information you can find is extraordinary. I'm doing a book on Long Tan at the moment. But in this case, yes, in 2015, it was the first time I said to a researcher, go hard, go into the archives, see what you can find. He came back with extraordinary stuff. The complexity of the Opera House is not simply how he came up with the design, but how do you build the bastard? You know, that's the thing that was really difficult for me to get my head around, was the complexity of trying to work out how you build it. And so I had to consult, my brother's a civil engineer, and, you know, he was the engineer on building Qantas House, involved in that. And so he understood, and he knew a lot of the people involved, and he understood a lot of the complexity. He helped explain it to me, a guy called Ron Bergen, who was an engineer actually on site. He was fantastic. But yes, what I really wanted was to bring to life this extraordinary building.
That's
I wanted
right.
to call the book Opera House, Where the Ruck Did This Thing Come From Anyway? Mm. And the theme of it is, you know, we have, Sydney has this extraordinary architectural jewel, this unbelievable building, the modern Eiffel Tower, the modern Empire State Building. There is no building on earth, modern building on earth, more revered than our Opera House. And so the question is, how did 1950s Australia, which was surrounded by a white picket fence, ate meat and three veg every day, went to church on Sundays, deeply, deeply conservative, you know, across the board. We'd had Menzies was in the middle of his, you know, longest reign, I think it was 23 years. How did Sydney, Australia, come up with this design? Where do we get it from? And how did we not only get it, but also say, well, we've never seen anything remotely like it, but we'll build it. And the stories that came out were absolutely extraordinary.
Yes, it's started off as a wonder of the ages just for that reason, but you've written it in biographical form.
Yeah.
But I guess the starting point for me is that the building name is itself a bit of a misnomer.
Yes, because there's a lot more than opera that goes on there. But the historical roots I found wonderful. I mean, it was that where it's built, that a long point. That was like, it was really more an island than anything. And the interesting thing about it is that when Philip came through the heads in 1788, outrageously, he organised, well, he gave the orders for the kidnapping of two Indigenous men. One of them was became known as Bennelong. And despite being kidnapped, Bennelong actually became friends with Philip, and they built a cottage for him on this, you know, harbour island, if you want to call it that, this point. And Bennelong became friendly with him and finally invited Philip and his senior officers to come down for what we know as a corroboree. And it's this amazing moment where you've got white fellas and people of the First Nations, and the people of the First Nations do this, effectively a dance, a chant, a dance, a corroboree, and for the first time the white fellas look at it and go, geez, they look You know, that these are rehearsed moves. They're singing the same thing. This is extraordinary. And it was a leap forward in them understanding that the Indigenous people had a culture all of their own, and a very sophisticated one at that. And how wonderful that the Opera House should come to have been built on what is effectively sacred ground.
When, once they got started in demolishing the tram sheds that were there.
Tram sheds, yes. Well, first they put up a fort. First they put up a fort to defend Sydney Harbour, which you know, I mean, Sydney was always petrified of being invaded. In the Crimean War, we knocked the top off. There was a what is now known as Pinch Gut at Fort Denison, right in the middle of Sydney Harbour, which is literally Fort Denison. It's a fort. The fear was the Russians would invade. This was the middle of the 1850s, and they built Fort Denison. And before that, they'd had the fort that was built there to defend, again, against the French or the Spanish or whoever was going to come. But yes, you're right. Then the tram sheds were built. And, you know, it's interesting because when I go to Auckland, which is used to be fairly frequently before COVID, it seemed to me the Aucklanders don't love their harbour the way we love our harbour. The Aucklanders, everybody can see their harbour because it's everywhere. And it's interesting to me that we should have built tram sheds 120-odd years ago because on that prime land, because clearly we didn't value at that point the ability to look at the harbour. Now people scratch each other's eyes out in real estate prices for a chance to get a glimpse at the harbour. But yes, so then they built the tram sheds, and it was a conductor by the name of Eugene Goossens, who was a European conductor, came out of England but had been educated in Belgium. He was very sophisticated, came to Australia in the late 1940s to conduct the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. When he was so good, they came back at him and said, we want you to do Sydney Symphony Orchestra and run the Conservatorium of Music. He did both on a good salary. He was the one that convinced the Premier, Joe Carl, you've got to build an opera house. And he was also the one that pointed out at Bennelong Point and said, this is the spot where you've got your tram sheds, your epoxy tram sheds. You've got to get rid of them and build an opera house there. And so then they ran this competition. There were 230, we're in the mid-1950s by this point, 232 submissions. They had a four-man, and they all were men back in those days, judging panel architects, one of whom was the famous Finnish-American architect, Eero Saarinen. He flies in a couple of days after the judging has of these 232 submissions has started, and says, all right, well, they said, you know, you're late, but here are the 10 finalists. He has a look at them and says, well, it's none of these. What else have you got? And then he, in the next 3 hours, he just turns over folder after folder. He gets to submission number 218, and he says, there, gentlemen, is your Sydney Opera House. They look at it and say, no, well, we rejected that. It's too, you know, it's too off the charts. It's not, you know, we've never seen anything like it. He gets them down to Bennelong Point. He puts them in a dinghy, a small boat, rowboat. He pulls out personally. He gets them up the back of the dinghy, and then he pulls out a drawing and of the opera house. And he says, I want you to imagine what this will look like. And ding, 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 three lights go on, and then they announce the winner. And in Sydney, a very famous architect, late architect, a man by the name of Harry Seidler. And Harry Seidler is probably Australia's most famous homegrown architect, or Australian architect, not quite homegrown, but he came here, I think, at about the age of 20, a little later, and he was a famous, highly accomplished Sydney architect. He entered the competition, was one of the finalists, but with extraordinary generosity, once he saw the winning submission, he said, the judges are to be congratulated. This is a work of extraordinary creativity. And yet, there were also howls of protest, absolute howls of protest. Somebody saying it looks like the cuttings of an albino dog in the Daily Mirror. The toe cuttings, the toenails of an albino dog.
I hope that image doesn't stay with us, by the way.
I always think of it as nuns in a scrum. But anyway, Joe Carl, the brilliantly skillful New South Wales Premier. He was a Labor Premier, and he was attacked, saying, "Well, why are you building, you know, Opera House for the elites?" And he said, "This is not the elites. This is for my Opera House will not be for women in mink coats and men with bow ties. My Opera House, this Opera House," he probably didn't say my, it would have been this Opera House, "will be for washerwomen and waitresses and plumbers and carpenters and labourers. It's for the people. They deserve the best of everything." And that was the initial conception of it. Woodson then is told that he's won, and for the first 3 or 4 years works out of his native Denmark until, you know, the construction starts. Although there's a fantastic story that when he first flies into Australia, comes to Sydney, I think it must have been mid-1958, he goes to see, for the first time, he lays his eyes on this site, and he absolutely loves it. Then he goes to meet with the Premier, Joe Carle, and he says to Joe Carle, "Well, Mr. Premier, you know, fantastic, I absolutely love it, I'm so grateful to have won, I'm looking forward to building it." And he says, "But I've got one problem." "What's that, Mr. Woodson?" "Well, on the western side of Bennelong Point, you've still got working wharves. We cannot have, you know, around this Opera House, you can't have the commercial shipping going back and forth." And Joe Carle says, "Just excuse me a moment, Mr. Woodson. Dorothy, can you get me the Maritime Authority?" Dorothy gets him the Maritime Authority. And before Woodson's very eyes, he says, "Oh, yes, look, it's Premier Carle here. Look, you've got working wharves on the western side of Bennelong Point. We'll have to move those." "Yep, thank you. Just see that it's done. Put the phone down." "Sorry, Mr. Woodson, you were saying." And I imagine the current premiers will read that with wow, the ability to do that. And so Joe Carle pushed it through, and the money came from Opera House lotteries, and there's a tragic story therein, which is the infamous, well, it's a famous Sydney story, but back in those days, Australia was so innocent that we never thought we'd get a thing like a Lindbergh kidnapping of the famous, infamous kidnapping of the Lindbergh child. We were a pleasant place with people that were pleasant to each other. And what happened was, we would put somebody has won, whoever's won the Opera House lottery, here is this person, $100,000 with her husband and her 3 children, this is where she lives, you know, with the address. Mm. And the 8th people to win were the Thorne family from Bondi. They won it on the Monday. They were in the newspaper on the front pages on the Tuesday. On the Friday, they sent their little boy walking up the hill to go to school from 8 Edward Street, Bondi, and he was plucked from the street by a kidnapper who made a phone call, said, "Unless you give me £25,000, you'll never see him again." And he had put the child in the boot, and basically when he opened the boot, the child was dead. And the body was found a month later, and it was an extraordinary story of forensics where one persistent policeman kept going and took the blanket that the body was found in, took it to Sydney University to go under the microscope. They said, "Well, yes, there's traces of pink mortar here, red brick pink mortar, and there is certain kind of grass, and there are the leaves of 2 particular kinds of cypress trees." This guy, this policeman, goes to Balgala Post Office, says, "I want to see your posties," and he gets in front of the post. He says, "Balgala was nearest to where the body was found. This is the kind of house that I'm looking for with these trees, this grass, this kind of brick and this kind of mortar. Have you seen it?" They say no, and then a month later, this guy is still out on the beat when he happens to be at a house doing a follow-up investigation, and the postie comes up and says, "Oh, I remember you. You came and see us, didn't you?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Did my mate Jacko get a hold of you?" "No, why?" "Oh, Jacko thinks he knows the house." And Jacko did know the house, and they were able to arrest the kidnapper and the one that was responsible for the death of the poor 8-year-old Graham Thorne. And that's a tragic story, but it's one of the stories that goes into the making of that Opera House.
You detail a lot of what was going on in the world over those 15 years from when the tram sheds were demolished, and the effect on a number of families. There were some tragic effects. We might just take a break there. Peter, we always ask our guests to pick a song. Have you got one for us? I guess it's a Bob Dylan song.
Yeah, of course it's a Bob Dylan song. Is there any other singer out there? Let's go with Tangled Up in Blue.
Early one morning, the sun sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed at all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress, Papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue.
And that was Tangled Up in Blue by Bob Dylan, as chosen for us today by our special guest Peter Fitzsimons, who is the author of a new book called The Opera House.
Bill, so, this is your show, not mine, but I can't wait to ask you. You've read it. What do you think?
It's gripping, I suppose, in one word. But, you know, I couldn't wait to turn each page because there was just so much happening. It's extraordinary. And you know, being a Sydneysider, and I grew up with this, I'm about the same age as Graham Thorne would have been if he'd survived. Right. Yeah, an extraordinary story. And yeah, I loved it. I loved it. It was worth all the wait. I've been waiting, as I said, I've been waiting for this book for a long time. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Peter, we were just talking about some of the other stories that got caught up in the building of the Opera House, and some of them were tragic on the various families. And I guess you start with Utzon himself, and then you think about Peter Hall, you think about Sir Eugene Gussens, who was fined £100, and yet his life was ruined.
The Eugene Gussens story is amazing, and I mentioned earlier how amazing it was that deeply conservative Australia could sign off on the Opera House, which may have been a sign of growing liberalism of, you know, okay, well, let's be progressive.
Republicanism, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, Utzon, strangely enough, was a Republican, which is what I found fascinating, and actually talked about Australia, the virtues of Australia becoming a republic. But the thing that with Eugene Gussens that was staggering is conservative Australia really turned on him because he had a strange mostly sexual predilection. And it wasn't, in my view, all sexuality, good luck to you, as long as it doesn't involve underage people. But in Utzon's case, he had a thing for, and I'm not telling stories out of school or behind his back because it was all through the papers. He became involved in a witch's coven. And believe it or not, as you're a Sydneysider, you'll know how extraordinary it is that Sydney's most famous witch came from Linfield. And her name was Rosaline Norton. And she put out these sort of strange art books, and it was sort of devil worship and gargoyles and all this kind of stuff. Gussens saw a copy of the book in a bookshop in Glebe, contacted her, went to visit her, and became involved in, I don't know if you call it sadomasochistic, but devil worship and candles and, you know, and physical interaction. And he'd go back to his native England, and at one point when he was going back, he bought all kinds of photos and sexual paraphernalia, somebody found out about it and tipped off Sydney Customs. He was arrested at Sydney Customs and charged by Sydney Police for bringing in, I think it was 1,000 photos. And they're photos that on the internet these days would not raise a single eyebrow, but his career was destroyed. And it's interesting you mention, you know, like it really hurt Utzon. Yes, to a certain extent it did. I mean, it was Utzon's greatest creation. It was a Rembrandt. It was a work of absolute genius. But in many ways it broke him because he, by early 1966, he was under so much pressure to bring it in on time, which, you know, the budget had blown out, the schedule had blown out. The government of Robert Askin, Premier Robert Askin, had taken over. Part of their election promise was, we'll rein the Opera House in, we'll get the job done, we'll bring it in, you know, in for less money, we'll stop the profligacy of the Labor government, and they put a lot of pressure on him. And Utzon basically wouldn't be hurried. Utzon was, I'm working on a masterpiece, I'm not going to be pressed for time. And in February of 66, he thought, if I offer my resignation, if I give them my resignation, and they will realise that they can't do it without me, that'll bring them to heel. So he gave them his resignation. They said, great, taxi, take Mr. Utzon to the airport. And, you know, we've been we're now 50 years on from that, and the controversy still 57 years on from that, 56 years on, and it still goes on. And it was, you know, was Utzon done down? Was he a genius? Did he deserve to go? And the answer lies, it's a very complex answer, but there is no doubt Utzon was an absolute genius. You know, he could conceive a building that, as I say, is the hero of modern architecture, and yet he was somebody that had never worked on a project the scale of the Opera House. And to my mind, that same genius that could come up with that design, it's not necessarily surprising that he wasn't also blessed with a wonderful managerial brain to keep on top of so many issues. And it's significant that when he resigned, he had, I think it was a dozen draftspeople. I think they were all draftsmen in those days. The feeling was the three architects that came in, so he was replaced by three architects. There's a fair sign of the workload he was under. They thought it could be done in 18 months. It took 7 years, and by the end of it, they had 118 draftspeople, and that was the problem. So the engineers were crying out for, we need drawings. There are over 1,000 rooms in that opera house, each one of them with, you know, electricals, air conditioning, fire escapes. You know, the complexity of it was just staggering. And the engineers who'd been contracted to build it needed designs on time to keep it going. And their complaint was that Utzon wasn't providing the drawings that they needed to keep going. And so it was an extraordinary process. But in the end, look at it. Just look at it, how wonderful it is. And the tragedy is that Utzon did not ever see it. You know, the moment that he flew out of Sydney, that was the end of it for him in Sydney. And later on, he dreamed about flying to Sydney, dressing himself as a woman, and going to see. So he'd be in complete, it's not that he particularly wanted to dress as a woman, not that there's anything wrong with that. That wasn't the point. He wanted to be totally incognito and look at his opera house. My newspaper, the Sydney Morning Herald, was run by Robert Whitehead at the time, leading into the millennium, the turnover of the millennium, going into the year 2000. And Robert Whitehead contacted Utzon and said, here's the plan. We at the Herald will fly you in to Sydney Airport. We'll put you up in a hotel at Botany Bay. We'll put you in a boat, and we'll bring you round the heads, and you'll sail up Sydney Harbour as the first light of dawn gleams on the new millennium, shining on your opera house while we film you. Oh, what do you say? And Utzon said no. What a pity.
Well, Utzon was described in your book as a brilliant architect, a generous mentor, an exceedingly good man, and he wanted to live in Australia. And then on the other side, you've got the politician, the Country Party politician, Davis Hughes, who you could describe as limited and petty in some ways.
Yes, I mean, Davis Hughes was Robert Askin's point man, his minister, to take over the Opera House project. And, you know, when he told his wife, Minister for Public Works, he said, but darling, you've never done so much as put a nail into a wall. You know, what do you know about great buildings? And he has become the villain, the bogeyman, where Utzon's the shining light, Davis Hughes is the bogeyman. And, you know, more or less rightly so, because, you know, in terms of genius or whatever, I mean, you're dealing with Utzon, who is a genius. But on the other hand, Utzon himself, so they were at war, Utzon resigns, Davis Hughes accepts his resignation, and then it's Davis Hughes that pushes through the three architects and more resources to get it done, and it does get done. The touching thing is that even though for much of the artistic world, architectural engineering world, Davis Hughes was a villain, even so, 30 years later, 35 years later, when Davis Hughes died, Utzon passed a message to Davis Hughes' wife, a very gracious message saying, you know, you have my deepest condolences. You should, let's face it, if not for Davis Hughes, we wouldn't have got the job done. Words to that effect, which was a wonderfully generous, gracious thing to do.
Yes, all led up to that, one of Sydney's greatest days, that opening in 1973, and Sydney was at its finest.
People talk about the Albert Hall, you know, in England they talk about playing, what's the famous New York one, Madison Square Garden, if you like. But if you appear at the Sydney Opera House, it's a big deal. people are proud of it. And one of the lines that I quote is Oscar Wilde, when he was at Oxford University and a very young man himself. He said, "Every day I find it harder and harder to live up to my blue china." And I love that quote because it was, you know, he was a young man. I've got this exquisite blue china. I have to live a life worthy of someone who owns such beautiful blue china. And the answer to that is, Sydney in Australia, we have the most exquisite opera house on earth, the most exquisite theatrical space. Well, we've got to rise up to meet it. We've got to have musicals, ballets, performances, plays, drama, putting on that stage of Australian creation that is the equal of the Sydney Opera House. And it has just entirely lifted Australia's culture, our entire image. Before the Opera House, our image was the sheep, probably Uluru, Ayers Rock as it was back then, boomerangs, koalas, you know, terrific. They're great things. But this was something that said to the world, we are a really sophisticated modern nation. Look at us. We can create something this splendid. And the world gasped in admiration, and they still do. And one of the things, one of the lines I use, my inspiration for doing the book on the Opera House, is if you look at, Bill, your Sydney side, so you'll remember. You'll remember in the 1970s, the Hilton Hotel on George Street.
Yes.
And we Sydneysiders were proud of that Hilton Hotel because we were so sophisticated we could go to the theatre. And even as late as 11 p.m, you could go to the Hilton Hotel and get apple strudel with cream and a cappuccino. And in 1980, something came along that blew the Hilton Hotel out of the water. It was the Regent Hotel at the bottom of George Street, now the Four Seasons. And we looked at the Regent Hotel and we went, that is just the most fantastic hotel we've ever seen. Look at us, how schmick we are. And here we are, 40 years later, the Regent Hotel, nay Four Seasons, or Four Seasons, nay Regent, looks to our eyes like a wet Wednesday afternoon. It's a dull-looking building. And whereas we look at the Opera House, and we're 70 years in from conception, 75 years in from conception, and it looks as sparkling as a Sunday morning in the year 2525, you know, with the sun shining after recent rain. It's that glorious, and it's never faded in its glory.
Look, on that note, unfortunately we've run out of time, but we could certainly swap stories about the Opera House for ages, and it's a special privilege to have Peter Fitzsimons on the show today. He's the author of the new book called The Opera House, The Extraordinary Story of the Building That Symbolises Australia, The People, The Secrets, The Scandals and The Sheer Genius. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. Or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me to once again thank you, Peter Fitzsimons, very much for being a guest on Dads on the Air.
Terrific to be with Dads on the Air. I'm a dad, you're a dad, we're a dad. Thank you. Bye.
We'll be back next week.